Good evening, everyone. Tonight I thought I'd talk about stress. Stress, because there's a lot of stress. It's a lot of stress in this world. I think it's getting worse. I think we always say that, but perhaps it's always true. Things might have just been getting worse and worse and worse for a long time. Maybe it's an illusion. I think my conceit as a Buddhist makes me want to say that the Buddha made the world a better place, and things have been getting better since then, in some ways. I don't really think that that's conceit, although, hey, there might be some conceit there, but I think there's a valid point to be made. Of course, every religion would say similar things, but It's hard to deny the power of the Buddha's teaching even today, 2,500 years later. So for the past 2,500 years, it's definitely been doing some good things, and perhaps having ripple effects in ways that we don't even recognize overtly. But nonetheless, Buddhism is starting to show its age. All formed things cease. Vaya Dhamma Sankara. All formations are of a nature to fade away. In Buddhism, not the truth that the Buddha found, but the teachings and the presentation of the truth that the Buddha gave is waning in some ways. The following, the intensity with which it's practiced and so on, which is, of course, why it's always heartening to come home to a center with meditators striving. Today, this morning, I don't know. Normally I don't see the craziness of the world so much, but I've been seeing it more and more. This morning on the bus, a man in a wheelchair wanted to get on the bus, but the bus was full. But he insisted. And it was probably the bus driver who made the first mistake of letting him on, because his wheelchair blocked all the other people from getting on. And he started talking and arguing with the driver, and then some guy in the back. I mean, this is Canada. This isn't America, remember? We don't do this in Canada, but I guess we do. I didn't even look back to see who it was. Sounded like a big guy. Mouthing off, I guess is the best way to put it, saying some things. So that's the second mistake. He shouldn't have antagonized this guy in the wheelchair, an older guy who I think he was just injured. I'm actually not sure. But only one of his legs was, he had a problem with one of his legs. But yeah, this guy at the back said something like, "Shut up and sit down," and proceeded to repeat himself and become more and more belligerent. And the third mistake was the guy in the wheelchair, who had been, you know, I guess was in the wrong in many ways all along, but escalated the problem and began to spout obscenities Anyway, I mean, I'm sure all of you come across these situations. It's somewhat unique for me too, I think. It starts to make you wonder what's happening with this world. It's so easy to lose faith in humanity, I suppose, when you see isolated incidents like this. I don't mean to suggest that the world is full of these situations. I mean, they happen. But they happen because of stress. I think everyone's quite stressed. That wasn't the only incident today. Seeing people with stress. One of my fellow classmates tried to kill herself recently. Another one of my fellow classmates broke down in front of me. I actually kind of made her break down. I gave her a suggestion about better ways she might, or it was kind of a reminder about taking exams, that it's not enough to know the subjects. When you take the exam, you have to like go over it twice and little tips. And turns out that she's under a lot of stress. And then our TA, who we were, or our tutor, admitted that she broke down yesterday, crying in class. She's a graduate student, and graduate student mental health is a real issue, more even than, well, I don't know, I mean, as much at least as undergraduate health. There's a lot of stress. I'm seeing a lot of stress. And that's only in this microcosm of school. Thinking about the stress that I hear about my students having to go through. I think one of my students once told me, "Bhante, you have no idea." I'm not criticizing me exactly, but I think gently reminding me that the stuff that you have to see out there in the world is the stress that comes. I mean, one of my students in America his mother was sick, and he didn't have a job, and how are they going to pay for health insurance? Imagine the stress of having to worry about basic things like healthcare. That happens even in America, which is supposed to be a fairly rich country. Another student who was trapped in a religious household. That's an encouraging story, actually. I told her she should, I suggested that she chanting. She was doing meditation, but she felt kind of desperate in her situation. So I said, well, do chanting to the Buddha. Chant the Buddha's homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dhamma, homage to the Sangha. And she did that, and as a result, she got a Buddha image, and she put the Buddha image, and she would chant to this Buddha image. And it's a cute little story, but it shows you the power sometimes of religious activity. Because the family she was with, of course, saw the Buddha image and demanded she get rid of it. They wanted to throw it. No, they didn't. They wanted to throw it out. And so she told them she'd get someone to get rid of it, and so she got a friend of a friend to come and pick it up. And when that friend of a friend came, it was someone who you know, was happy to receive the Buddha image, and as a result made a connection with her and invited her and found a job for her. I never heard back from this woman, but it was a cute story of how chanting to the Buddha actually helped her leave a very bad situation, you'd say by coincidence. But if you look closely, it also had to do with the quality of her mind and the focus of her mind, which kind of segues into, you know, the idea of dealing with stress, right? That our minds our minds are essential. Stress doesn't come from the outside world, though we generally think that that's how stress is caused. Stress is caused by our environment. Stressors, we call them. But a stressor requires a vulnerability. You can't make someone stressed about something that doesn't bother them. School is something that bothers a lot of people for various reasons. They've had it ingrained into them, this tension about marks and exams and so on. The importance of grades, the importance of success. We have this attachment to ego. When we're criticized, it stresses us. When we fail, we have this need to succeed. We have these negative self-confidence factors, or low self-confidence. Feeling that we're imperfect, that we're inadequate. And so we worry about succeeding, we worry about being sufficient. Sometimes we're afraid of the future. Simple things like worrying about healthcare, worrying about food, worrying about money. Going into debt and worrying about being able to pay off your debt. Worrying about your families, your children, your health, other people's health. Worrying about the world, politics. How much energy do we put into this circus of politics? It's become a real, I think it always has been, maybe, this circus. Watching while people hold our fates in the palm of their hands, it seems, no? It's people who play with our welfare, play with our lives, and we get stressed about these politicians who seem all equally corrupt. We worry about violence, war. We worry about the climate. Now we've got one more thing to stress about. It's getting warmer. The ice caps are melting. Weather is becoming chaotic. We worry. We worry about our weight. We worry about our skin. We worry about our age. I'm getting older. We worry about death. A lot of stress in this world. But my point was that it's our worry, it's our concern that causes us stress. Somehow we have the idea. Not somehow, many somehows, for many reasons, we get the idea that we should be worried. We should be concerned. And so ultimately, first of all, it's important to recognize that we shouldn't be concerned. For the very basic reason that it's insignificant, it's meaningless. It doesn't matter whether we destroy the climate. Doesn't matter whether we ruin the world. Doesn't matter whether we are fat, or doesn't matter whether we break out in zits, or Doesn't matter whether we fail the exam. Doesn't matter whether we get food to eat. Doesn't matter whether we're healthy or sick. Why doesn't it matter? It doesn't matter because in the end we're all going to die and be born and die and born again and again and again. Sometimes it'll be fun. Sometimes it'll be not so fun. It's not important because ultimately the universe is infinite. I don't know if it's infinite, but it's pretty big. I don't know if it's going to last forever, but it's going to last a long time. There's no appreciable end or beginning to the rounds of samsara. So in the end, all these things that we worry about are categorically insignificant or meaningless. There's no meaning to life. There's no purpose. I'm getting worse and worse. Now this is getting more and more depressing, I suppose. Well, if I can laugh, I mean, it can't be that depressing, right? I think it's good. I think that's the wonderful paradox of Buddhism. We laugh, we smile, we become happier the more we talk about all the depressing things in the world. How meaningless is it? Because how awful it is. How much stress comes from trying to find meaning in this meaningless world. Trying to find a rhyme or reason. That's where God comes from. That's got to be the most obvious reason why we create God, is because we want meaning. We're trying to make sense of the senseless. We're trying to find patterns in chaos. There's no pattern. Patterns are temporary. And actually, it's absolutely liberating to give up any sense of purpose or meaning. Ambition. Lao Tzu said, the master weakens their ambition and strengthens their resolve. I don't know if he actually said that. That's just one translation. But I always like that thought. Weakens their ambition and strengthens their resolve. Now, before you all ask, but, that doesn't sound right, right? It doesn't sound right that there should be no purpose. Well, there is kind of a purpose, but let's be careful here. Let's be clear to delineate. There is no purpose in samsara. There's no purpose to the universe. There's no master plan. There's nothing behind this saying, this is what you must do, this is what you should do. But there are ultimate truths about reality. Suffering. Suffering is distinct. I mean, I guess sort of let's back up a little bit. Reality is, and this is a claim, but this is a truth claim that Buddhism makes, reality is experiential. It's an important realization from a Buddhist point of view. Obviously, there are other people who discard this claim. Reality is personal. So it's almost as though we each have our own universe, where it's almost a solipsistic religion. Solipsism, of course, is the idea that only you exist and nobody else exists. Buddhism is almost solipsistic, but it's more like, I don't know, there's got to be a word. Maybe we need a new word for it. Maybe there is no word yet. We're all in our own universes. But these universes touch, you see, right? And they intertwine. So we connect with each other, or we impinge upon each other's universes. But nonetheless, only I am in my universe. You'll never feel what I feel. My feeling is distinct from your feeling. So it's a personal universe. And all that means is that what that means is that things like suffering, rather than simply being and what you'd call emergent phenomena are actually real, right? You won't find suffering on any periodic table of the elements, but you find it on the Buddhist periodic table of the elements. That's the kind of thing I'm trying to say. Whereas material scientists have come up with hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, oxygen, etc., we've come up with lobha, dosa, moha, citta, cetasika, rupa, nibbana. 122 citta is our periodic table of the elements. And then it's further refined into 28 rupa. No, it's not. So there's the 121 citta, then there's the 52 cetasikas, I think, and then the 28 rupas, and then the six aspects of nibbana. Altogether, I don't think I've ever added them up. 121 plus 52, I hope I'm remembering that correctly. 173 plus 28. 201 plus 6 is 207. It seems to me, if I've counted them correctly, there's 207 elements. But the important, the significant aspect of that is that suffering is included in there. Stress is included in there. Stress is something we wouldn't think of as an ultimate reality, right? I think to some extent we've marginalized this aspect of reality for that reason. Because it doesn't fit, you can't look around and see suffering. Well, of course you can, but what I mean is it's not a thing, it's not tangible. And so we minimalize, I think, and marginalize mental health. We marginalize things like stress and so on. And we try to find physical ways of getting rid of it so we can go back to focusing on the material world, right? Things that are tangible, real. Because suffering isn't on the periodic table of the elements. It's not real, in a sense, right? Do you see how awful it is? I talked about this last night, this akasaloka, the idea of space-time as being the essential underlying reality, and that the mind is simply a emergent phenomenon, they call it. It's terrible. It's an awful philosophy. It's an awful way of looking at the world. Who cares if it's quote-unquote right or not? It's not even that important. I mean, it's just subjective, that right or wrong. There's a much better way of looking at the world, and that's from the most basic aspect of personal existence. And so suffering is real. That paradigm shift, I've talked about this before, that paradigm shift is the first stage of insight knowledge. It's a very, I think, a very clear way of understanding the door, the entryway into insight. How do you know if you've crossed the boundary from, say, tranquility meditation or conceptual reality into vipassana meditation or ultimate realities? You start to look at things from that's not even fair, sorry. Samatha can also see these first stages. So how you've passed into the realm of meditation, let's say. It's when you start to look at things from the point of view of experiential reality. I suppose you stop thinking about the room that you're in, and instead you think about how you're seeing the room that you're in. You're seeing, you're hearing. You start to realize that the experiences are what's creating the room. Seeing and hearing and smelling and tasting and feeling and thinking. They give rise to reality, not the other way around. When the mind ceases, the world ceases. I think that's a Buddha quote. I have to go find it. I think it's in the Samyutta Nikaya. With the arising of the mind, there is the arising of the world. When the mind ceases, the world ceases. So a tree couldn't fall in the forest without anybody around to hear it. If that sounds somewhat odd or maybe even downright wrong, then you may have a different way of looking at the world. But this is where we begin. We begin by, we don't really care about, we could argue all day about which way of looking at the world is right and wrong, but the way of the Buddha is useful. Useful in ways that the materialist way is not. Materialism can give you little pills that dampen your emotional responses, but it can't change your mind. It can't fix your problems. It can't help you understand. There's no pill that gives you wisdom. I have one meditator here now, and I was explaining to him, I said, you know, this practice might take year, might take lifetimes, I said. He said, you know, how can I overcome this? I said, well, it might take lifetimes. Forget about years or months or days. And he said, well, that's not very encouraging. And I said, well, I'm sorry, I don't have a pill for you. I think it's important that I make it clear that you don't try and solve all your problems right now. It's not going to work. There is no magic pill to solve your problems. But just because it's going to take a long time doesn't mean you should, you know, what, go back and stop trying to make yourself better. Stop trying to heal your mind. I think it's quite encouraging to think that in a few lifetimes I could be completely free from suffering. It's pretty encouraging, considering how long samsara is, right? But it's important not to be complacent. We have a certain, and so this is getting back to this certain drive that is good, this certain zeal, interest, and this certain push. But it's much more about focus than anything else, because our mind is always active. It's not like to meditate you have to suddenly activate your mind. Our mind is overactive. All we have to do is tap into some of that energy and redirect it. Let's say, wait, rather than stressing over this thing, why don't we simply, you know, instead of all that energy we're wasting, why don't we use some of that energy just to know it as it is? So it's not like meditation requires ambition. We've got a lot of ambition already. All we need to do is rechannel it. Don't make it about ambition, make it about clarity. Sit back, relax. Yeah, it's such trite advice. I would never give someone the advice to sit back and relax, but in context, the point is, meditation is relaxed. It's just we're not very good at it. It's a state, not necessarily where you feel calm and relaxed, but the actual act itself is not frantic. There's nothing frantic about mindfulness. There's nothing stressful about mindfulness. It's a simple, like a drop of water in the pond, sending out its ripples. Mindfulness is like a squirrel in the forest. When I was, before I had ever practiced Buddhist meditation, I was reading Taoism, of course, and one morning I was sitting in the forest. I had taken up the work of making maple syrup in our forest, a 200-acre forest that I grew up in, and so I was sitting in the forest, the snow all around and the trees, listening to the dripping of maple sap into the buckets. And listening to the squirrels, and I just had this idea that squirrels have the right idea. Squirrels don't, no, I don't know, it's a silly idea, but they are pretty frantic, aren't they? But squirrels don't do anything big. Squirrels don't try to change the world. They don't try to do anything in the forest. They just go about their business collecting nuts. But they have this incredible power along with all the other animals in the forest. They create the forest. They do so much with so little. It's kind of a silly analogy, but I think it applies here. Mindfulness is not forceful. It's not doing a lot. I think the squirrel analogy is kind of apt because people get kind of frustrated when they come here and they say, "That's it, you know, you don't have something more for me. What do I do about this though? I want to be happy, you know, I want to be free from this. I want to relax." And then I'm like, "So do you say to yourself, wanting, wanting," which is not the answer they want. Not what they want to hear. Come on, it can't be that simple. Be like the squirrel. Be like the squirrel. Don't try to build the forest. Don't be a squirrel. They're awful animals. But think like this. Think about the squirrel as being very minimalist. It's the idea of minimalism. Do as little as possible. Keep your mind free, because see, the problem, you compare a squirrel to a human being. A human being tries to fix things. Look at how we've tried to fix the world. That's most of what we've tried to do. We tried to make the world a better place to live in. We've tried to bring more happiness to ourselves. We've really tried really hard to do good things, you know? And look at what we've done. We've made a mess of everything. Because we try too hard. And I think this applies, you can apply this just as easily to meditation. We try too hard. We try to do too much. I want to fix this now. I want to be enlightened now. You know? How do I get rid of the pain? How do I get rid of the stress? And as a result, make it harder. Make it more stressful. They lengthen the path. The best way to make it, to lengthen your path, to make it take more time, is to want it to be over sooner. The more you strive to become enlightened in a short time, the longer it's going to take. To an extent, I don't want to denigrate those people who come here and do the good work of intensive meditation. That's the best, of course. But it's more of an attitude. If you come here for 10 days and then think in terms of, today I want to be free from suffering. If you come here for 20 days or so, you know, or however many days, it's not that. During your practice, you need to have a measured approach. You can't think about the future, even in terms of future gain. What am I going to get out of the practice? You have to be here and now. Everyone's focused on happiness. Too many meditators are worried about happiness. Why am I not happy? Here I'm meditating, and why am I not happy? It's kind of like the climate change deniers. They say, well, there's climate change. Why is it cold here now where I am? You know? Similar attitude. Meditators fall into the same silliness. I'm not happy right now. Meditation must be useless. Never focus on happiness. Here's the best words of advice I can give. Never. Even when you're happy. Sounds odd, no? Why wouldn't I? When I'm happy, isn't that why I'm doing this? Sure. But as soon as you start focusing on the happiness, you stop doing that which makes you happy, that which brings happiness, which is goodness. Happiness doesn't bring happiness. It's not the function of happiness. It's the function of goodness to bring happiness. So if you constantly focus on goodness, even when you're happy, right? Okay, I'm happy, well, back to doing good things. Back to purifying my mind. Back to cultivating mindfulness, then you'll always be happy, and you'll be happier and happier and happier. That's a good outlook to have, both as a meditator and as a Buddhist and as a human being. So There you go. A little, some thoughts about stress. I think those are good thoughts, and I'll leave you with that. I'll say that's the Dhamma for tonight. If anybody has any questions, I'm happy to entertain them. Yep, if you got a question, just go ahead and ask. No need to ask permission to ask. You have my permission. You can also shout it out if you want to turn on your microphone, but you can write it. Kalandaka Niwapa. Yeah, I think they still feed squirrels there to this day. The bamboo grove, Weluwana. Weluwana was the first monastery. It was given by King Bimbisara. It's in Rajagaha. Rajagaha. Rajagaha is a wonderful place. There's a real feeling of the Buddha there, or there's a real feeling of Buddhism. It's just a wonderful feeling when you go there. If you walk up Vulture's Peak and you see the stones at the top that still kind of look like a vulture, and you see where the Buddha, where these little caves were that Buddhist monks probably stayed in generation after generation. We assume that human life is precious. Well, that's not an assumption I make. It's a sort of precious rebirth because we can practice Dhamma. Mm-hmm. Right, it's a rare birth. Maybe the Buddha said it's precious. I know Buddhists often say it's precious. I won't deny that. Let's go with it. Shouldn't we be concerned about the climate change that could put an end to life on Earth as we know it? Mm. Right. Well, I was kind of giving a more philosophical... I have to put a qualification on the whole meaningless stuff, because that's, philosophically speaking, it's important to understand that in the end it's all meaningless. I mean, our enlightenment as human beings is also meaningless, in the sense that there's nothing behind it. So you become enlightened, okay, that's enlightenment. You might say, well, that's good for you. It is, it's awesome, it's the best thing you could possibly do, but really there's no God up in heaven clapping his hands saying, bravo, good for you. Well, maybe there is, it's true. But it doesn't mean anything, even if he is. That's all I meant. I mean, personally, and in terms of your practice, you don't want to be that, I suppose, nihilist in your thinking. You want to be clear of what's in your best interest, because suffering is real. And that sort of, I should have probably explained further, because clearly suffering is real and it's bad, and so you don't want to suffer. And so there is, in essence, a sort of a meaning there. Right, don't want to suffer, then what I should do, remember using words like should do, is try to free myself from suffering. That's pretty clear. So that gives meaning to life. So that's the qualification, is that you can it's very clearly that you should say things like life has meaning, I have meaning in my life, it's to free myself from suffering. But philosophically speaking, there's no meaning, and that helps you free yourself from suffering because you stop worrying about things, you see. It's important. It's sort of paradoxical, I suppose. The best way to live a meaningful life is to see that life is meaningless, right? In a sense. So, should we be concerned about climate change? I suppose. I mean, we certainly shouldn't be worried about it, and worry is a problem. We should be aware of it, and as with everything, we should approach it with wisdom and understanding and act accordingly. Concern and worry are not at all useful, helpful. And that really comes down to the point, is that climate change isn't the problem. The problem is humans trying to fix everything, trying to make everything better, more pleasant. It's because of human greed. But even still, you know, we don't know when the next asteroid's going to hit Earth. We do know that eventually the sun's going to collide into Earth. But we don't really have to worry about things like climate change, because they're the product. You know, if we'd only listen to the Buddha and stop being so greedy, angry, and deluded, we wouldn't have climate change. We'd get along. Any hint of environmental degradation, and we'd work together to fix it, to solve it. Heck, we wouldn't even degrade the environment in the first place. In fact, from a Buddhist point of view, the degradation is a direct result of the degradation of our minds. I mean, you can see that indirectly. But there's even a sense that the whole sort of a magical sort of correlation, as our mind degrades, our whole world magically, it seems, degrades. So there's even a sense that it doesn't take all these intricate cause and effect webs that scientists are looking at. It's just a direct causation. But maybe that's not true. Maybe it is, you know, you couldn't see it through. Maybe you can see all of this through a microscope, but maybe there are some aspects that you can't. Like, look at the quantum mechanics. There are certain things that you just can't see through a microscope. That's quite profound. So, anyway, I mean, what that exactly means, I don't know. Hard to have right livelihood. Well, there's a lot of things that are hard. Being a good person is, no one ever said it was going to be easy. Becoming enlightened is certainly hard. Doesn't mean you shouldn't do it. I suppose that's an important point, is just because something's hard doesn't mean it's not worth doing. The easy path is not, I mean, this goes without saying, I think it goes against our training. We've been brought up to succeed, right? And that translates into succeed by any means, and so we're not prepared to give up our success in favor of things like right livelihood, which is too bad, really. We should be able to give up much for goodness. Should be able to give up everything. Well, you don't have to. Yeah, I mean, that's just a personal problem. You don't have to be worried about the effect of your job on others. I guess you could argue that, yeah, it's important to be somewhat aware. You know, if you're selling people poison, that's probably something worth fretting over. But you don't have to worry too much. You know, if your mind is pure, you can do many things that But if your mind is impure, there are many things that are going to disturb your mind. Like this woman who laid out the traps for her husband. She was a sotapanna, but she still laid out these traps for her husband, who was a trapper. She didn't want animals to die. She just wanted to do right by her husband. Her husband needed the traps cleaned, so she cleaned the traps. Put them out for her. Put them out on the table. Not she didn't set the traps, but of course, in India in those days, probably she would get beaten if she didn't. I mean, not even in those days. Even nowadays, throughout the world. So, rightly, livelihood ultimately is more about right action and right speech. If you're making your livelihood by killing, stealing, lying, cheating, then it's wrong livelihood. But it's also already wrong action, so. Most important is not to do those things. Right action, right, wrong action, wrong speech. Any more questions? Do you mean we should be aware about climate change and do our best to fix it without worrying about the result, without worrying about anything? Right, well, worrying is, you should never worry regardless. Whether you should actually work to fix climate change or not, I would say not. I would say your efforts would be far better focused on changing, first of all, your heart, purifying your mind, but next, helping other people to purify their minds. Because climate change is just the symptom, it's not the problem. We can't have our cake and eat it too. We can't live in a beautiful world and destroy it at once. You know? We can't have instant gratification and still live a stable, satisfying life. So our quest for instant gratification and you know, security against suffering is gotta end. We gotta stop being full of greed, anger, and delusion. Sangha asked a question? Oh, I missed it. What about a person who serves alcohol working at a bar? I did that after I started meditating. And I thought about this woman. I didn't work at a bar, I worked in a restaurant. And some people ordered beer. Most people ordered food, and that was great. It's great being a waiter because you can bring people food and you feel like you're humbling yourself and serving people and just helping out. Sort of a good feeling. This is before I was a monk, of course. But sometimes they would order beer, and I kind of struggled with it. But I thought about this woman who laid out traps, and she wasn't encouraging them to drink. She wasn't, I think a bartender might be different because your whole job description is alcohol. But my job description was to bring people things they wanted, right? So they wanted alcohol. They wanted a bottle of beer. I can bring them the bottle of beer. I don't know what they're going to do with it. Maybe they'll pour it on an open wound or something. Okay, I'm not that naive, but there's an argument that could be made for, I was trying to be very mindful as I brought them their cold bottle of liquid. I'm not sure about that one. But again, it's not wrong livelihood in the sense that you're not killing, stealing, lying, cheating to make a living. Now, if you make money off of the sale, if you're the actual proprietor selling these things, I would say that's a more clear violation of what the Buddha called miccha vanicca, wrong mercantilism, economics, wrong livelihood basically. But vanicca is a merchant, I think, or Well, it's a drug. Cigarettes are a drug. So working in the cigarette industry, you get a good job in the cigarette industry, but you're struggling about it. I get that. I think that's problematic. I'm working in a restaurant is one thing because it's mostly about food, and you can say, well, there's alcohol, okay, so it's not perfect. It's not something I'd probably want to do again, but working in a tobacco industry, your whole industry is tobacco, which is such an awful thing. There are very few good purposes to tobacco. I think there probably are some good to it. I don't know what happens if you chew, if you eat tobacco, maybe it's not so bad for you. But in the end, a job is a job. I'm not sure about that one, but it's not something I'd want to do. Of course, I wouldn't want to do anything but be a monk. Oh, tomorrow I get to go and tell a. Tomorrow I'm invited to a. I think it's a world religions class. I can't remember what. What is it? Oh, it's Indian religion. Anyway, one of my good friends here, one of my professors last year. He's a Tibetan Buddhist and he goes to Tibet every year. He's invited me to talk to his class about Buddhists, the struggle in Indian religion between renouncing the world and living in the world. So he wants me to talk about my experiences, talk about myself. Which is always kind of awkward, but anyway, I'm gonna go. So I wish you all a good night. See you again tomorrow. Oh, wait, one more. What's going on here? Abo meditation practice. I have done retreats in Jomtong. Ah, well, welcome. That's where I was ordained. but I stopped daily practice. I want to start again. Do I have to start from the basis that you describe in your booklet that I found online from the... your English is not so good. Checking isn't a word. Checking about practice? I have to join the Surya Mangala Practice website. I mean, it's up to you. If you want to follow my teachings, if you want me to teach you, yes, the booklet is a good place to start. I require that you practice according to that. But if you've already gone up and done higher stages of walking and sitting, then we can consider that. I mean, you'd have to describe to me how far you got in the practice, what you actually did at Chom Thong, but best thing would be to do, if you're interested, is to sign up for one of the slots on our meditation website, meditation.surimangalo.org. Sign up for a slot and we can talk over video conference and talk one-on-one about your practice and figure out where to go from there. There's one of the women online has done foundation course at Chom Thong, the full course, and so I'm doing it, and she's done advanced courses as well there, so I'm going through some stages of the advanced course with her. I've never met this woman, but you know, I didn't make her start all over again. All right, well then, good night, everyone. Same place tomorrow.